welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man that is currently being chased by a gigantic monster wall. It's John Levengood.
By a gigantic monster wall?
Yeah, like in the movie, in the Mouth of Madness. At the end, they created a monster wall.
I don't know about all those creatures, man. We didn't see them very much, but what we saw was enough for me to be like, I want the story of the things at the end of that hall.
Yeah, you know how they do Tales from Jabba's Palace, and they would cover all the monsters, or Tales from the Cantina from A New Hope, and all the monsters got their own chapters? I want this, because the work by KMB, what Kurtzman, Nicotero, Berger, they created a 20-foot wall. They had 14 people inside of it pushing, and then they had three separate puppets. And John Carpenter's favorite was the big raisin-looking thing with a mouth. That was coming towards them. That was his favorite of all the monsters. That's the one he liked the most.
I thought it was weird that one of them was like a monster that had an extra set of extra large arms that kind of rotated back and forth.
Yeah.
As it moved. And then there was another one that looked a little bit like
those were on pistons, those arms.
Huh?
Those arms were on pistons shooting up and back and up and down.
It looked like that. They're rotating, yeah. Right? And then there was the one that looked like a shorter mouth-tentacled version of Samael from Hellboy.
Well, I mean, Del Toro was heavily influenced by Lovecraft, so you could totally see that happening for sure.
Right, and then that raisin face thing, I don't know, man. That almost looked like in Poltergeist 2, when Craig T. Nelson literally vomited out the manifested spirit of Cain as a torso with no limbs.
Ooh.
You remember that?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? It's a brutal scene. Made me think of that thing.
Or a California raisin.
Or an actual California raisin.
And Nicotero was talking about it, so they were all excited to work with him, and it sounded like the big raisin was their least favorite, but it was Carpenter's favorite. At the end of every day, he's like, oh, man, that thing. But that's the beauty of this movie. There's some really neat monster creations in this movie. And watching it again after a long break, I got the Scream Shout Factory Blu-ray with the two commentaries, all the different interviews. I was watching it again with my wife, Megan, and she loved it. This is her favorite of The Thing, and she liked it more than The Thing, and she liked it more than Prince of Darkness. This is her favorite of the Apocalypse.
So she prefers Act 3 of the Apocalypse trilogy.
Yeah, and by far, by light years. She loved this. Well, she loves books. And so watching this, and Sam Neill's performance, it's just beautiful in this. But we were watching it, and there's a gooey door, there's tentacles, there's gooey monsters. I was like, John loves this. There's just gooey. I have never seen a gooey door before, and I am 100% certain when John's Horror Corner saw that gooey door that was holding back the old gods, he went, I love this movie. Like, you bought the poster, you bought the soundtrack, you learned the guitar riff from John Carpenter's score. You
on air guitar.
Yeah.
With my leg.
And, but that'd be funny if you could actually play it, but you just prefer to air guitar it.
Right. Something that I love about the Carpenter's Apocalypse trilogy, in addition to the fact, independently, I adore these movies, right? I mean, we both adore these movies, and it's just that it's not like any other trilogy. You know how we can say Alien, Aliens, and Alien 3 are completely dissimilar movies? One's a sci-fi thriller suspense. One's a sci-fi action movie with some horror elements to it. They all have horror elements. And the third one is almost like a drama,
yeah,
if you will, on that prison planet. And so, but these are dissimilar to me in an even greater way than that, because in this case, we don't have any common tie of storyline. There is no continuity to be made outside of fan theory. Between these movies, you have The Thing, which is a very basic, not basic in a crass way, but a basic monster concept augmented by human psychology, like, right, what am I trying to think?
Survival instinct, paranoia.
Right, the atmospheric dread. You got Prince of Darkness, that's higher concept horror, right? That was more intellectualized in its themes, and it was trying to make some, not heavy-handed, but it was trying to it had a theme of theology meets science. And a very different kind of foe. One is an alien foe. This one is kind of a devil-like anti-god foe. And then in this, it's essentially these Lovecraftian elements in this more fantastical horror, right? It's like, and the monstrous concepts are very coupled with Lovecraftian madness. And that's something that we didn't really have in the other movies to any such degree. There was just the madness of distrust and cabin fever. There was the madness of being touched by darkness, but you were literally possessed by it in Prince of Darkness. But
oh, wait,
this,
cabin fever, you mean the thing?
Yes.
Okay.
No, like cabin fever, like they have cabin fever.
Oh, got it.
Like they have cabin fever,
I was
right,
like, they're ripping each other's flesh off and falling into lakes?
Right. But then, like, I mean, and Mouth of Madness also differs tremendously in its huge use of varied imagery. We do not have varied horror imagery in the other movies. The imagery is always of a particular motif in each of the other movies. And this, it's all sorts, and we're world building. We don't do world building in the other two movies either, except for conceptual in Prince of Darkness. So these movies,
and they don't move much. Sorry, John. Like in Thing, they're at the outpost. And then in Prince of Darkness, they're at, I mean, they start off at USC, but then they go to the church. Very contained. This one's quite sweeping in comparison.
Right. This is a road trip.
A mythical road trip.
Right.
Yeah. I'm going to say something controversial, John, and I want to see what you think about it. So I'm on record saying that The Thing is a perfect movie, and I stand by it.
Agreed, wholeheartedly.
And you know I've said that. You've known me for 20 years.
I'm with you right there with Back to the Future.
Yeah, exactly.
The Thing and Back to the Future go together like peas and carrots.
Perfect. But if someone walked up to me on the street and said, listen, I'm going to, you know, like the only way you're going to get out of here alive is if you watch one of these Carpenter films. I'm taking In the Mouth of Madness first. I don't know why this situation happened, but if I had to just casually watch one of these, In the Mouth of Madness.
Really?
It's 90 minutes with credits. Short, breezy, fun. It's not, you don't have the unbridled tension and paranoia and stress of The Thing. And as much as I love Prince of Darkness, the cheeky gags take me out of it. And we talked about that at length, which I still like it, but it's still just the cheeky gags. And I mean, I love it, but I don't think the actors are as good in The Thing as they are in The Thing or in The Mouth of Madness. But in this one, I mean, you have Sam Neill putting in career work, right? You have Linda Stiles crushing it. You have DP Gary Keeb with his Panavision camera that John Carpenter loves and the wide-angle lenses knocking that out the park. You have the kind of rock score, like legit.
Oh, yeah, during the opening credits, that was so – it actually felt more late 80s with a good soundtrack like Elm Street 3.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that. I just think everything – I love the wide-angle shots of Toronto. You know, they shot in Canada. I love the wide-angle shots that they had. I love the theme of it. I can't get enough of this movie. And so if someone said rank these movies in terms of quality, I'm going to say – which is unfair, but I'm going to say Thing, In the Mouth of Madness, Prince of Darkness. Agreed. But which would you rather watch? I would say In the Mouth of Madness, The Thing, Prince of Darkness.
I'd always have The Thing first myself.
Wow.
I love that movie so much. Yeah, I can watch that any day.
You know what I mean, though, when I say, hey, it's perfect on every level. I mean, even the hats are great. But I think Sam Neill, his performance in this movie, and Linda Stiles, I mean, but their performances are so knowing. They're not tongue-in-cheek, but they know what they're in on. They're loving it, and it's just, I don't know. And after listening to the commentary, we listened to the new commentary with John Carpenter and Sandy King. And my wife loves Sandy King now because Sandy King is hilarious. She was just ripping on, who's the head of New Line? Bob Shea. And John's like, okay. Mm-hmm. And then she just got ripping on him. But they got that church. That was in the middle of nowhere. That was a real church.
That
was a Greek
church really existed?
Yeah. In the middle of nowhere in Canada.
Oh, Canada. Yeah.
And they went to it. They were supposed to go to this wooden, old rickety church. Carpenter saw the Greek Orthodox church. The production designer quit. Because John Carpenter didn't want to go to the one that the production designer went on, so they hired a new one. They went into this church. They made a deal with them that they would pay for all new carpeting if they would let him shoot there. And so eventually when they learned what the script was, they tried backing out of it and the producer wouldn't let them and they all got new carpeting. But it's like, after listening to this commentary and how cool John and his wife are, Sandy, they're just the coolest. That commentary, I love the behind the scenes footage. I love that it's 90 minutes long, John. This is a short movie. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot in it. There's a lot in it.
And you know what? It never drags. It never feels short. It never feels too long. I love the gags by KNB. I love listening to the behind-the-scenes interview with Nicotero because he says the word gag about 48 times, and that makes me happy because I love a good movie gag. The monsters are very inspired, and it's just a thrilling, like, you know, like, there's a guy here with swollen testicles that says, you wanted to get out of here. I was going to introduce you as that, John, but I figured it was wrong. I don't know. There's just so much about it where it walks a tonal tightrope much better than Prince of Darkness, but I still love the themes of Prince of Darkness, and it's Prince of Darkness you have to watch close to get the really neat themes that aren't shoved down your throat at all. It rewards a watch, patient. This is long-winded, but I love this movie, and I'm glad that we did this trilogy because it reintroduced me to the film.
You know, this strikes me as also being part two of the Sam Neill Inquisitive trilogy. Jurassic Park in the Mouth of Madness, Event Horizon.
Yeah.
He plays very similar archetypes in each, bringing in his expertise of something. And then there's either a mystery or a problem that he now has to use his expertise in an unexpected way. And then in one way or another, you know, things go off the rails and get a little crazy and dangerous and some almost world-endable theme.
That's really interesting. Yeah, Jurassic Park.
Dinosaurs could be released upon the world.
He's recruited. In this one, he's recruited to go do the job. And then Event Horizon, they recruit him to go find his ship, the Event Horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And it all goes horribly awry.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's interesting. That's a good one, John.
Yeah, it's very similar characters.
Similar in air quotes.
right. Not that anything was like replayed or like someone's playing an Indiana Jones-esque character and something. No, it's not that. But I love him in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. These are probably my favorite Sam Neill movies
He puts work in. In these, and they're genre pictures. You know, Jurassic Park, let's say, had the prestige because it was Steven Spielberg. I can't believe I almost forgot that name. But he took a leap of faith on Event Horizon. Well, actually, he didn't take a leap of faith within the Mouth of Madness because it's John Carpenter. But he went for some funky properties, and he rolled with these. I mean, just the crosses on his face and the nonlinear storytelling and just the interesting vibe that he went through and the time loops. It's a good... In the Mouth of Madness, Charlton Heston pops up in this movie. Like, what? What's happening? Like, it's a...
Dude.
Oh, it's so
good. And Viggo the Carpathian.
Yes.
Who is also a goon in Die Hard appears in this.
Yeah. And his kids. You know what's the freakiest visual in the Mouth of Madness? We see a four-legged, a normal dog running, being chased by children. Later on, we see that it's a three-legged dog, and the kids have become little monsters.
And one of the girls, the little girl in particular, is specifically monstrously made up,
mm-hmm.
and she has blood on her mouth. So I think that she pulled that dog's leg off like a Renaissance fair turkey leg.
Whoa. I want no, I don't want to see that. No. I don't want the NC-17 cut of that. And they actually found a three-legged dog, and that it got loose on set, and they had to chase it down before the take. Just to let you know that in the commentary. But this movie, I mean, John, do you want to... I mean, if you're listening to this, you know the film, and we don't have to spend 2 hours recapping it. But, John, can you break this movie down in 40 words or less?
Okay. An insurance investigator is hired to locate a missing ultra-famous Stephen King-esque writer and ends up on a road trip to a town that doesn't exist, where he loses his mind.
Whoa. And he realized that he's just a part of the book. Sutter Kane.
Do you read Sutter Kane?
I like Stephen King, Sutter Kane. The winks that make me so happy.
So what I love too is, so I post on Facebook when I'm watching movies. So I just post the movie poster. Everyone knows shamelessly whatever kind of crap I'm watching or high film I'm watching. And I have people commenting when I post it sometimes on different social media platforms who I know very well and who I do not think of as horror fans at all. And so some dude, a good friend of mine who is not into horror movies, who specifically dislikes horror movies, writes, "Do you read Sutter Kane?"
Hey,
this is comment. It's like, that is a known line. Like, people know that line. If you've seen that movie, that sticks with you.
And you know what's interesting? My wife, well, she likes horror, but she doesn't like all horror, but she loved this too. But I think that's because there's John Carpenter was talking about this, and he brought in cosmic horror into it. So, I mean, as much as we love The Thing, it's just an alien plops on Earth and is frozen, and then these Norwegians on thaw it, and then it attacks Kurt Russell and Keith David. That's cool. But then you get Prince of Darkness, which, I mean, it has the anti-god and has this... It's more like science-y. Would you say the explanation of all this? I mean, magic and science combined. But this one's just straight-up cosmic, sci-fi, novel, kind of high... Like, a lot of this film is built around the dialogue. The action scenes are few and far between. I mean, Sam Neill gets thrown through a door. He kicks a guy in the balls. But this is another sort of – it's kind of a trippy cosmic horror film that just has such a unique tone to it. And maybe it speaks to non-horror fans.
Yeah. I mean, it's very much embracing the Lovecraftian elements that as you look in deeper into the void, or as you see the indescribable color out of space – you are touched by the madness, and the madness grows. And at first, you don't understand how it's affecting you, and then eventually you are overtaken, and you are part of the entropy. And this movie does that very well with – I mean, we see it most linearly with Sam Neill's character, Trent, but we also see it with his travel companion. We kind of see – I guess, glimpses of it in the townspeople of Hobbs End. And before he even goes, the fans of Sutter Kane, simply those who have read the words of the void, if you will, in air quotes, not that this is said in the movie, they are drawn into madness. So we see in all directions and in different ways, we see this madness, this pervasive madness spreading. It's infectious. It's like The Thing on a sociological scale.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, it's, yeah, just a worldwide catastrophe. Then they all move inland after eating everybody on the coast.
Right, in New England.
Yeah, I love that. But no,
we're starting with good beer and massholes and higher education.
They take out the monsters take out the green monster.
Right.
Yeah, no, I love it too. And you know what's interesting for me is this. I don't think this movie ever tries to throw a curveball at you. It's quite clear when they're traveling, this town doesn't exist. And so they kind of get zapped into this town. They see the person on the bike. Then they get into the town. Well, this isn't how the book reads. Oh, don't step there. That's normally there. Then you see the monster. It spells everything out for you quite. It doesn't try to pull wool over your eyes, is what I'm saying. It's a good ride that just, I don't know, it's just, what am I saying, John? What's a better way to explain this? But
it forecasts all of its reveals.
And it says it in the beginning, too, right? What does she say? She says life is, I have it in my notes. I can't find it. I take notes like a madman. When she's like, what is existence? Like, it's what you make it, and it's when they're in the car, and they're sort of having this conversation about what's real. It's all foreshadowed in the movie.
Yeah, and again, they tell us a lot in the movie. You know, we know he ends up in the mental asylum.
Yep.
We know that already. And once he's put in there, he seems content to stay there.
Yeah.
So that's very telling. And when again, she mentions that the old lady who runs the inn, or Trent. Sam Neill brings it up that can't be the woman from the story. That's a sweet little old lady. She wouldn't harm anybody. In the book, she chops up her husband into little bits.
Mrs. Pickman.
Right. But then she does it. And so all the things, yeah, it forecasts itself well. There are no like holy crap moments. It's just like, oh, that sounds creepy. Oh, there it is.
Yeah. And at the ending, you know what's interesting for me is when I finished the thing, I never sat there and thought, which one is it? Who did what? Because it was such a satisfying experience for me. I just said, this is great. I don't care. This is such a fulfilling thing. I didn't want to ruin it by overthinking it.
You know, back then, before social media, we hardly even had the inkling of to have discussions of, well, which one do you think the writers and director had to be the thing? Is it either of them? Is it none of them? Instead, you finish the movie thinking, oh, dude, and you don't even know which one might be the thing. You're content to be wowed by that. Like, I wonder if one of them is the thing.
Yeah.
We'll never know. Whereas now everyone's going online like, I think that they meant this. No, I'm pretty sure this was implied and everyone has to have the answer. And it's fun to get the answer. But back then there was, you know, when you watch this movie, well, I didn't watch it in 82 because, you know, I was one. But I probably saw this movie for the first time when I was 11. And it was a little much for me. At the time, it's so much more mystique.
Yeah.
About movies without all these trailers with spoilers already built into them, without reviews all over the place, canvassed everywhere. Mm-hmm. I miss that mystique, but I love where we are now.
No, so, for sure. I mean, we're just moving forward. It has to happen with how connected we are. But I guess for me, with the thing, I just went, I love it. I don't care. Prince of Darkness, I could care less if that guy was dreaming at the end. I just like the movie. This one, I feel like I understand exactly. He just, John Trent knows what happened. He's a part of the book. He has no control. He's learning the story. And that's it. Like, there's articles out there where, I was reading this article, The Ending Explained, and someone wrote...
Are you going to upset me right now?
What? No, they're like, they're asking a lot of questions. Oh, at the end of In the Mouth of Madness, we're left with a series of existential questions. The first being whether it's even possible to discuss the film's ending without sounding totally high. No, because I get the joke, but this is just a guy who was written by Sutter Kane, came into creation, brought the book back, the world ended, and then he realized it when watching the movie.
I mean, really, Stranger Than Fiction starring Will Ferrell is just a more grounded retelling of In the Mouth of Madness.
But yeah, and then... They put, to put it mildly, what is and isn't real is left ambiguous. I don't know. And are the final moments in Trent's mind snapping after encounter with brain-breaking Eldritch monstrosities? Or is it Trent really just a cog in Kane's fictional universe? Or if so, was he always a fictional character or was he a real person absorbed by Kane's imagination? And then it's like, is the movie Trent watches a film within the film or is Carpenter's film itself... Is Carpenter's film itself the film within the film? Was anything that we watched real? But I don't know. I never asked one of those questions because I felt like I understood it.
Agreed. I think that this is an incredibly interesting movie, but it's almost like I feel like positing those questions is trying to make the movie sound even more interesting than it is to someone who hasn't seen it, who would then find out, no, the movie's already that interesting. Why are you asking these questions?
Yeah.
And I agree. I think it explains this. I think that you either say all of this is a nonsense fever dream, right, a fantasy, or it's exactly as we see it transpire. But to say that it's all a nonsense fever dream of fantasy or, you know, a madness fever dream is kind of like just the one direction or the other of are they still in a dream in the end of Inception?
Yeah.
It's inconsequential, in other words. It doesn't matter. This review posits it as if it matters or if there are things to figure out. I would argue, as I think we've already established, there isn't really anything to figure out. This is handed to us. Maybe this reviewer watched this more casually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're paid to do reviews and they did three reviews and watched three movies that day and they were getting a little movie fatigue. I don't know. I'm not trying to make fun of this person, by the way.
The writing's good. I mean, I love the idea of how do you explain this movie without seeing high. The prose is good.
Right.
I'm just wondering aloud if I'm different than most people because I just never had those questions. because it always seemed obvious to me. And that's fine. Maybe I'm different, but that's
just... You ask that question after you watched Mandy. Yeah. When you watch Mandy and you're reviewing it, you can say, how do you explain the third act of Mandy without sounding high? And that makes sense to say.
Yeah.
There are certain movies for which that makes sense to say.
So this roaming group of Partridge Family cultists and some Cenobites torture and murder Nicolas Cage's...
Some clearly fantastical Cenobites.
Yeah, murder Nicolas Cage's girlfriend. He's left to live, then he goes on a massive bathroom scream, gets a bow and arrow from the guy from Commando, a crossbow, goes to the Cenobites' home...
Forges a heavy metal axe.
Yes! Goes to a meth dealer who has a tiger, then goes to a then hunts down the Cenobites and has an epic brawl with them outside of a flaming car, snorts 12 ounces of cocaine, goes to a massive pyramid, has a chainsaw fight, and then kills Partridge Leader. You're high.
Well, just this, when he fights the Cenobite in the apartment.
Yeah.
That first one wearing the mask.
Mm-hmm.
See, that to me alone is the most, like, otherworldly part of the whole movie for me. That and him forging this weapon.
Yeah. And those, you know, because they weren't... They took damage that humans can't take.
Right, right. Now, I mean, they were clearly, like, fueled by demons.
Even if their bodies are so loaded up on a bad drug, I just... Something into their skull and brain would kill them. So there's some form of Cenobite magic.
Or at least severely inhibit motor function.
Yeah, exactly. What a beautiful film. That's an art film right there. I would watch In the Mouth of Madness for Mandy, too, because Mandy takes you places. You know,
it takes a bit of a toll on you, even though it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a physically draining movie, and I adore it. In the Mouth of Madness never physically drains you, though. It's a fun ride. It's a very fun ride. I never felt drained.
I think that the combination of Trent's skepticism,
his sassiness,
his aggressive, or assertive, occasionally even like it's almost laughable. It's like, how can you believe this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is reality. He opens the window. See, there should be a church there, a Byzantine church with 250-foot spires. And then she says, no, that's this window. Like, it's almost, you know, it's meant to draw a couple grins.
Yeah.
As things are revealed, in addition to being shocking at times.
I love how she makes the trip, John. Sorry to interrupt. She makes the trip, and then he wakes up. He's like, oh, you drove all night. This is great. Thanks for getting us here.
You found it. You found it. She's like, no, you don't understand. I don't know how I found it. He's like, no, that's great. You found it.
He's such a schmuck.
So it's a cross between that skepticism and not the laughs, but the grins that we get from that skepticism and the what I will call the high diversity and frequency of different kinds of effects and horror concepts and mm-hmm. creatures and supernatural enchantments or whatever, right? We see all these different things going on. So it's very entertaining. It's not like a zombie movie where, oh, well, this is exciting because this time the zombies came out of this sewage and they're wet, bloated zombies.
Poop
and these
zombies.
Other zombies, right? These other zombies are we're all dried up and you know, like they're more skeletal. And it's just a different – in this, it's like, no, there's zombies and then there's vampires and there's Frankenstein. And there's, you know, it's like it's jumping all over the place. This is probably why kids thought Monster Squad was a blast back in the day and why I still think that no matter how much a lot of people hate it, Van Helsing is a blast in 2004 because we get all the monsters.
Yeah.
So we get this diversity of creatures and they're even presented in different ways. And he's literally – someone is peeling reality like a page of paper mm-hmm. before we see the hallway wall of monsters. We see an old lady with tentacle breasts hatcheting her husband. We see all these crazy things. God, and when she does her exorcist walk with her twisted head.
Yeah.
Like there are all these cool gags going on. The little kid from made me think of Cronenberg's The Brood.
The Brood.
Made the little blonde girl look monstrous. There's so many great and even just the scene in the very beginning with the Do You Read Sutter Kane and you see that his pupils are splitting. Like he has a pair of slightly fused irises and pupils in each eye. The things are just everywhere. There's so much to take in, but it's not complicated.
Mm-mm. And that's a beautiful moment you talked about when the manager comes to kill Trent, because they're at a diner. The camera's focused on them, but it's really deep focus. You can see what's going on in the back. You can see what's going on across the street. So it's the diner, a sidewalk, a two-lane road, a sidewalk, then stores. And you can see all of it. It's a deep focus shot. And what I love, too, my wife Megan went, this is a really deep focus shot. You can see everything. And that's when the guy with the axe starts walking towards Trent. So it's a really well-planned-out shot by John Carpenter to have this deep background shot, everything in focus, and just having this person walk towards camera without them noticing because they're too busy talking about insurance fraud. It's just Carpenter at its finest, and it's thrilling. Thrilling. I love it. All right, so how about this? Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, I have some funny observations about 1994 horror for you. How's that sound?
Done.
All right, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. And John, I was thinking about this. 1994 had its own dark universe.
Oh, dear.
So all of these films weren't universal. But 1994, Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Wolf. I always say Wolf, like W-F, W-U-F.
The Jack Nicholson, James Spader, Michelle Pfeiffer Wolf. Yeah.
Wolf, right? Oscar winner, Jack Nicholson, Werewolf.
Wait, can I do the Johnny Carson, and I'm going to hold the card up to my head?
Yeah.
Was Mary Shelley's Frankenstein 1994? Yep.
De Niro.
Okay.
De Niro.
Yep.
As Frankenstein.
Right.
Now, you can do it. You can do the next one. I know you got it.
Wait. Dig deep. Not Bram Stoker, because that was earlier.
Dig deep. You love this movie.
Interview with the Vampire.
Yeah.
Interview with the Vampire. Yeah.
Tom Cruise, because he was the A-lister at the time. Brad Pitt was getting hot. So you had Wolf, Interview with the Vampire, and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. De Niro, Sharon Stone, Michelle Pfeiffer, she was huge. You had Jack Nicholson, Tom Cruise, Antonio Banderas. Like these were massive casts.
Well, Kirsten Dunst won an Oscar for that.
What, Helena Bonham Carter, too, was in that movie. Tom Hulce, Oscar winner. So you had Wolf, Interview with the Vampire, and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. You had the 1994 Oscar-winning Dark Universe right there.
Those alone, combined with this, make that a great year for horror.
Look at this top. Okay, here's my top five, and people can argue with me. I love The Crow, but I don't know if I would add it into horror. But here's my top five in 94. Wes Craven's New Nightmare, In the Mouth of Madness, Wolf, Interview with the Vampire, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. That's a pretty strong top five. I mean, you could add Brain Scan in there. There is Mosquito, Hellbound with Chuck Norris, Serial Mom, A Shallow Grave, but that's more of a thriller, Tammy and the T-Rex, but that was a comedy. But yeah, the horror wasn't too strong in 94, but it was A-list.
Yeah.
There were some big guns in these. Isn't it wild how from 94 to 96, how 96 just you know what? I'm going to say it. 96 Scream revolutionized horror. It kicked off a brand new wave of an appreciation of horror, I would say 96 did. Because like 94, 95, they weren't the hottest years for horror.
Well, I mean, they were only hot in the sense that they were giving us classic retellings of classical horror.
Yeah.
And that's what allowed those movies to work, and they did them with big casts. And
I mean,
that was
huge.
Unusual. That was unusual. Even Bram Stoker's Dracula a couple years earlier. Whoa. Like it was unusual to get strong casts in horror back then.
Think about that. Bram Stoker. Holy, that was a great episode. You should listen to it. John and I recorded about 3 years ago, and it's one of our most popular one of our most popular episodes. That's a good one. That's top 10. That's top five right there. If someone asked me, hey, Mark, what episode of MFF should I listen to? I would tell them that.
That was probably around 195, episode 195-ish.
And then 1995, here, check out these movies. You had Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, Species, Vampire in Brooklyn, Dracula Den, Loving It, Village of the Damned, Tales from the Hood. Demon Knight, that's the number one right there. You don't mess with Demon Knight. Congo? Candy Whale, Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh, Screamers. Hey, Castle Freak, that's your movie, John. John just wrote a review for it on Movies, Films, and Flicks. But yeah, I mean, there wasn't I mean, there were...
I put none of them at the quality of any of your top five for 1994.
I put Demon Knight.
I think that's a fun movie, but if I'm really going top five, I wouldn't have it in my top five, but you'd have it in your top five.
Yeah, I put it top. Okay. I put it. Oh man, that's tough. So okay, 94 has. I would do In the Mouth of Madness, Demon Knight, New Nightmare, Interview with the Vampire, and Wolf.
It's a good list.
I just love Demon Knight. Like, Ernest Dickerson crushed it. It captured its tone really well. I owned it when I was 13 on VHS, and it just rocked my world. So I have the nostalgia factor going towards it.
I enjoy that monster. That monster felt like it was played off of the Twilight Zone, the movie, Plane Gremlin.
Hmm.
I feel like that played heavily on that. And then I feel like that same idea, but now morphing more from Demon Knight, was what was kind of modified a little bit for Feast. That kind of, that demon look, we've seen that in different things. But I think that it originated with Twilight Zone, and then Demon Knight made it, you know, well, still gooey, and just kind of tweaked it and contemporized it a bit. And then Feast was just like, we don't care how tactful we are with the monster. We just want to make the movie bonkers.
Make it nuts. And I forgot to read in the commentary, John Carpenter called the monster wall the running of the rubber monsters. That makes me so happy to hear.
When you watch that movie, okay, I've seen that movie so many times. I've seen it 3 times in the last week for obvious reasons right now. I saw it twice a year or two ago when I bought it to review it for our website. And I've probably seen it another 5 times at least before that. And even around viewing 7, 8, 9, 10, every time that monster wall comes up, I want to reach for the remote and pause it.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm just like, there's so much there. You don't see it for long. In reality, we know that if we really got a good look or you've extended that scene, it's almost like the visions of hell in Event Horizon.
Yeah.
It's presented to us in that way for some tactful reasons, but it remains very effective. But if you wide shot and gave us 30 more seconds of the visions of hell, you'd realize the production value of it in Event Horizon. And now it's not. Now it's just gross. Now it's like a gross smut film.
And you're right. And they filmed some of the gnarliest stuff. And I wrote down in my notes that this is Sam Neill's minimal monster thing. You don't want to see more of. I love the minimal views that we get. And Event Horizon.
Abundant views.
Yeah, abundant.
But none of them very long, right?
In Event Horizon, they give you enough, right? They give you a piece of chocolate cake. But to give you all of it, it's just a whole, you know, 24 by 24 foot inch chocolate cake, and you got to eat all of it. It's just too much. Give me a slice of cake, I'm happy. And that's what the monsters and hell visions are in The Mouth of Madness and Event Horizon. That's a weird comparison. I'm hungry. Actually, I went on a hunt the other day for scones, John, and this place I went to wasn't open, and I was really depressed. So I went to another place, and I got donuts at a place called Dutch Monkey. Really great donuts. But it never satiated my scone.
When
craving.
Hunting scones, what weapon does one use?
Okay, coffee. The coffee sword, if that's it.
The sword? Like a lightsaber of coffee?
Yeah, exactly. Wait. A catapult with a cauldron of coffee.
A trebuchet with a cauldron.
In the back of my truck with a piping hot coffee.
And a one-armed albino orc is going to launch it.
And then spit on rocks. No, but, John, I'm so happy that you picked this because it's... I have a question for you. And this is maybe my one hypothetical question. And I know the answer to it in my head. I don't think there's any right answer, but I want to hear what you think. When the monsters take over the insane asylum, which was a water treatment plant in Toronto, they murder everybody in it. It seems like the door is what is keeping Trent alive. But when he wakes up, the door is open and it has scratches, blood. Is Sutter Kane wrote that in the book? He seems to be somewhat protected by Kane because the monsters never kill him and his door is open, correct?
So my perception of that is that is probably one of the few vague things, right? Actually, now that you bring it up, I wasn't thinking about that as I watched it, but I did have an assumption. And that was more that Trent is one of the evil pawns of Kane's story. Trent likely participated in it, but with his madness, Trent does not realize that he is one of the monsters. It's almost like waking up after you turned into a werewolf covered in blood.
Ah.
So in this case, he's not covered in blood, but I believe that he was one of the many responsible. But his particular madness, we're seeing the world through his view.
Mm-hmm.
This is his psychosis.
Yeah.
So that's my take on it. But I like yours too. There's an elegance in his protection in Kane's manipulation of the story.
Because he read the book, so clearly he's going to become one of them. You read the books, mm-hmm. you become one of them.
He may already be one of them.
Yeah, no, that's his form, right? And he's being kept safe, and they don't attack him because of that?
Well, if he's mad, he might not realize what his form is. We're seeing his view of himself.
Yeah, I love it. And that'd be funny to see a monster going to the movie theater at the end and just laughing.
It's like he's in the Matrix. He's wearing sunglasses and a trench coat when really he's wearing like a dirty, crusty tank top when he's plugged in some seat on the Nebuchadnezzar, right? I think that we're seeing I can't remember what they call it, the self-realization or something or other. I think that's what we're seeing in him.
And I never was really worried about it because either way, you know that he's part of Sutter Kane's plan and this book is written and that's what the plan was. So I never had any existential crisis about why he wasn't murdered or big questions or bad questions. You know, sometimes you can watch movies, John, and you can have bad questions. Does that make sense? Like, why is that there?
It's not a bad question. Why did he put crosses all over himself in his room when God is never really brought into the equation? God or protection from God or attacks on God. We happen to be in a church, but I looked at that as just Sutter Kane's iconography, that he is the God of this world.
Yeah. And the old gods have gotten to him.
Right. And so he has taken the God of the townspeople. He is now the God of Hobbs End and eventually more. But it's not really an attack on God in terms of like some religious battle like End of Days or Constantine or any of that. Right. So, or at least it's not presented in this movie very clearly to me, outside of, again, more parallels that I go in a different direction on. So when he had crosses all over himself, it was interesting. And I also found it particularly interesting that on his forehead, he had an iron cross.
Yeah. There were different variations of the crosses that he had on his head.
Right, right. And of course, everyone thinks of the iron cross as like a Nazi thing, but well before it was a Nazi symbol, it was not that.
Yeah.
So they just appropriated that and put it in their regalia. But so he had an iron cross on his forehead. So there were some interesting choices there. I'd love to hear that extrapolated upon, because at some point someone was discussing this.
They never talked about it on the commentary. I feel gypped.
Right. So I thought that was neat. But it was cool when John Mahoney, what a wonderful him, between this and Gremlins 2, he had an era of just mania, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
But I love John Mahoney. I loved him when he later played Lex Luthor in Smallville even. I like him almost every time I see him. But he's this glib. he doesn't seem to fit in our reality on Earth.
Yeah.
He's a little too glib and chipper. He is the animated version of, I can't remember his name, Friedson or something, who was Hannibal Lecter's psychiatric director.
Oh, man, what was his name?
Like, maybe I'm way off. But he seems to be, again, like the...
Wait, the dude from Deep Rising. Is that who you're talking
Rising?
About?
Well, I don't remember him from Deep Rising.
Oh, his...
I haven't seen Deep Rising in a long time.
That's a weird poll. I was just watching the Deep Rising commentaries. Let me pull it. Anyway, before I go crazy, let me find Anthony Held.
But yeah, he makes me think of Mahoney makes me feel like he's the chipper animated version. If this was the Roger Rabbit movie, he's the character of that.
You're thinking Dr. Frederick Chilton?
That's it. Frederick. Yeah. I was thinking for some reason I was getting like Friedkin or something out of that. I was brain farting all over the place.
And I pulled it from Deep Rising.
But no, like he was an interesting character, and it's interesting that while he seemed to be the most in charge, he didn't actually seem authoritative. He didn't necessarily seem knowledgeable about anything but the goings on in operations. He didn't seem like the psychiatric director.
No, not at all. Just,
you know,
director of operations.
He had to check on things. But I don't know. That was an interesting character. That was an interestingly written set of decisions that I appreciated. Him with the music, not line readings so much as cue readings, like the way that his facial expressions were as he reacted to Sam Neill struggling and then kicking the guy in the balls, like.
And this is another movie where John Carpenter had the patience to show that orderly walking away from his room for about 15 seconds while sort of limping.
Yeah.
Like, movies don't do that nowadays. He just, 15 seconds of, oh man, Sam Neill got me good. Oh man. Like, it's just, it's interesting. It's a rare 95-minute movie that does take its time. This is going to sound weird to say. It's always moving, right? There's always a sense of going somewhere, of traveling, of moving, but it never does so in a breakneck speed. It's an interesting film, and I wonder, you know, it only made $9 million at the box office, which kind of blows my mind, but it's also not, if you think about it, Sam Neill had Jurassic Park, but I don't think Sam Neill wasn't an A-lister at the time, because Jurassic Park was about the dinosaurs, was about the, you know, experience, not so much about the actors. So it didn't have an A-lister. Carpenter had some kind of decent hits, but it just seemed like an R-rated, high-profile, high-concept movie. Like, teenagers probably wouldn't have enjoyed this. And probably a lot of adults at the time didn't go see it, because if you looked at what the horror films were in 94, they didn't have a good name. I mean, they were kind of dreck. So it had a lot of things keeping people from watching it, and that's why it's a cult classic, because people watched it years later and went, holy crap, this is good.
Yeah. So many creatures. I'll bet that if a teenager went to see it, they'd have fun with it for the creatures, but the level of energy is not what they are used to.
Yeah, it's not.
But the creatures, man, the little demon, it wasn't just a face on the back of his head.
Oh, yeah, that was
Sutter
crazy.
Sutter Kane had like a whole demon growing out of the back of him with arms, and when she's kissing him, she's like really like caressing the back, the front of this demon's face. See his little arms reaching around, like the old lady. I love the old lady, and when she turns into a tentacle monster.
Oh, that was a miniature. Beautiful.
That was so cool. Yeah. And then, you see, I thought that originally on a first viewing, I think that when they reference the tentacled creature in the greenhouse, that's the old lady. But in this case, I'm not sure if it's the old lady further transformed, or if it's just another creature. It's probably just another creature that lives in the greenhouse. And then just the painting.
Yeah.
The painting and the in-lobby was so cool just by itself as a non-creature creature. And when Viggo the Carpathian, I don't remember his character's name, but it's inconsequential. But when our shaggy-haired, clearly Eastern European guy blows his head off, which they don't even show us, but he blows his head off, like, that's a scene that gives gravity to Trent's realization that all of this isn't as fake as he thought. And that's so funny that he kept thinking this was like a small town of actors that were hired, because originally it was so barren. He thinks that they're putting on this huge charade for the multi-millions or tens of millions of dollars of insurance money they would collect for a disappeared Sutter Kane. There's so much going on, and yet, again, I say a broken record. It's so easy to follow.
Yeah, yeah. You never lose track of it. It's never dishonest. There's no – and even though there's a bit of an unreliable narrator, you still get it. And also, before we get back into it, what do you think was on Sutter Kane's back, that demon? What do you think that was? What did you read that as?
So just by coincidence of other movies I've seen, even though the movie I'm about to reference has nothing to do with this visual, I thought of The Dark Half, which is also an Evil Rider movie.
93.
Was that Timothy Hutton?
Yeah, Timothy Hutton, Stephen King. Yeah,
I thought of that. And so then I'm starting to think that maybe Sutter Kane was not always an evil, fantastic entity. Maybe he slowly transformed himself into one, and as people started to believe in the world that he was writing, it created power and an apotheosis, and we are literally seeing the demonification of him, the apotheosis of him. But instead of him becoming a thing, it is him splitting. We're seeing the fracture, the literal fracture of his humanity, albeit turning evil anyway, this pure entropic creature from the void.
I see it.
That's my take on
it. Oh, yeah. The dark half.
It's his dark half. It's his Timothy Hutton half.
It's beautiful girls.
Of course, in that movie, I think it was just a split personality, but much less menacing. But yeah, that was so cool. You know, I think that that might have been a play because the first time I ever saw anything like that, and I've seen it set in several movies actually now, Demons did something like that, and so did Phantasm 2, where kind of a creature emerges from someone's back, but not like bursting out of them, but like it was always inside of them. You know, when it comes up, there's a cavity from which it emerged, like that fits it.
Yeah.
So there was some weird stuff in those movies. I really like that visual, though. It's a really cool visual. They even did that in one of the American Horror Stories when it was just the kind of that wizardly like circus runner played by Shane West, something like that. The kid from American Beauty. Where on the back of his head, he had a little face. And they said that if you got close to it, you could hear it whisper. I think that these concepts actually go back to Japanese mythology. Some of the Oni demons, that's a redundant term, but some of the Oni, which are demons, had things like that. A face literally on the back of their head.
Hey.
They're drawing for everything. I don't know if that's as far back as it goes. I just know that from like Dungeons & Dragons because it uses a lot of mythology.
Nice.
There's so many neat things in this movie. So many neat things. And again, that door that almost burst, that door almost seemed biological.
Yep, your gooey door. And what about what about the door that Sam Neill gets thrown through?
He gets thrown through a door.
That's my. And then there's the dimensional door
that they tear through like paper.
And I mean, I just love when the confessional scene when he tells Sutter that his books suck. He's such a sassy guy, man. It just makes me so happy. You know, it wasn't here before I wrote it.
But he's a great spaz.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then the one-punch KO that he lands on Linda. He hated doing that scene.
He flaps her many times. I feel like released today, that movie, they wouldn't make the movie that way.
So Sam Neill hated filming that. That's the one thing that Carpenter said he hated doing. Because he just... And he's like, if you watch it, he never even comes close to popping her because he hated doing it so much.
Sure. But I'll bet that he also hated getting a shard of glass in his neck when in the mental asylum cell scene.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, there's some great behind the scenes stories on these. You know, what's interesting, too, is he ended up getting Cronenberg's production designers for this movie because they're Canadian. So it's pretty cool that he teamed up with his crew. And he called it a fantasy horror film. And I agree. It's a fantasy horror film filled with some neat visuals. It's a lot of fun. It respects the audience, but it never tries to take you for a ride. I'm glad we talked about it, man.
I love this movie. I haven't encountered people that I can recall saying that this isn't good. But at the same time, I don't feel like I hear enough people say that it is.
Because it's... Yeah, I guess it's just not as accessible as people would like, but it's just so good. I mean, I'm glad
that might be true. I don't think I ever watched this on a streaming platform.
Yeah, IMDb has it at 7.2, Rotten Tomatoes 58%. That doesn't make sense to me. I much more agree with IMDb on this. And I think that's where people are at. But when it came out, it only made $8 million in the United States. So let's add inflation, right? At $20 million most. That's not a big hit. Mm-hmm. And then it probably didn't move on VHS. And then when Scream hit, it probably became quite redundant. And so it's probably had a slow, you know, cult following of people who love it that has grown. But it's still not as accessible as – it's still not as out there as The Thing, right? It doesn't have the Halloween vibe. So it's – I think it's struggled because it's so successful at what it does. And that's just a fantasy horror film that's really smart. But it doesn't offer – raw boutine, special effects, that kind of stuff.
It's so satisfying. Watching Sam Neill laugh in the movie theater at the end, I don't know. That was very satisfying for me.
No, it's beautiful. And, you know, I think maybe if Nick Cage starred in this movie, this would be much more popular. But I like Sam Neill much more. But because of that, since he's not, I mean, he's been in gigantic films, but you don't hear many people going, I'm going to go hunt down that Sam Neill picture from 94.
That's, you know, I think you got to be a real movie buff just to know Sam Neill by name.
Exactly.
Either that or like Jurassic Park is your favorite movie. So either Jurassic Park is one of your favorite movies or you're a tremendous movie buff. Otherwise, yeah, I think that his name's going to escape most people, even if they grew up with his movies.
Because I think Jurassic Park, I know when people think about Jurassic Park, they do love the characters. I mean, Malcolm, him, Laura Dern, hold on to your butts, like Newman. But it's at the end, it's a dinosaur picture. It's a Spielberg picture. It's not Nick Cage in Con Air. It's not Sam Neill in Jurassic Park. But, I mean, he was in Hunt for the Wilder People. I love that. And a lot of people are probably mad to say, oh, he was in this, this, and this. But I think one of the things is just it's a successful movie. It's not it's not like there's no gratuity in it. It doesn't feature a lot of monsters, but still a lot of fun. It's smart. It's well made. The tone is good. And I think it's just I think it has enough of an audience to warrant this Blu-ray release. It's just not. It needs more love, John. Hopefully we can do that with this.
Well, yeah, hopefully we'll get some people out there to buy it. I was telling my lab mate, Michael, about our covering this movie, and I was telling him how it was the third of this Apocalypse trilogy. I explained what the Apocalypse trilogy is, and he's like, you know what, John, you've lent me like 12 movies that I haven't even watched yet. He has two very small children, so yeah. He doesn't get to watch movies much. He's like, but God, you know, like – and he hasn't been borrowing any new movies when I say, like, do you want to borrow this? He's like, no, I got like a stack of them. I got to get to some of these first. He said, you know what, John? Like, give me that one. Let me throw that in the stack. Let me throw that in the stack and see if I can get to that when I told him about this one. So, you know, I mean, just by me talking about it and how excited I was to record this episode, he wanted to watch it.
Watch it.
So,
do it.
So
do
we got at least one, Mark. We've already gotten at least one with our enthusiasts.
So if you're listening to this, send us a message. And if you watch it for the first time, let us know what you think about it. We want to know that we influence people to watch this picture. Absolutely. So please do that. But John, thank you for joining me. This was fun.
This is a blast. Any excuse to watch John Carpenter films, I mean, you don't have to twist my arm very hard. And definitely don't twist a dog's arm too hard, because we see what happens when that happens in a movie.
Like that poor dog. Medieval times.
I'm telling you, that dog got Renfaired.
Turkey leg. Oh, that girl ate his leg. Its leg.
Recently.
Ugh.
Like, she might have dropped it right before the camera hit her.
Oof.
It might have been in her hand out of frame.
Oh, man. She might have killed one of the townspeople with it.
She might have just bludgeoned them to death.
She kills Vigo
with their own dog's leg.
Poor Vigo just gets beaten with it.
That dog just hopping around.
Well, thank you for joining me, John. This was great.
All right.
All right, so for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, for John Levengood, this is Movies, Films, and Flicks. We'll see you next week.